I don't think you can have reform in this country unless we have media reform. I don't think we can have democracy in this country unless we have media democracy.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
Today on Tell Somebody, former Federal Communications Commissioner and acting FCC Chair Michael Cox for the hour. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Welcome to Tell Somebody for April 9, 2015, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, @TellSomebodyNow. Look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook and like it. And remember, you can subscribe to the podcast for free at the iTunes Store. This is your host, Tom Clammer. Michael Copps is Special Advisor for Common Causes Media and Democracy Reform Initiative. From 2001 to 2011, he served as a member of the Federal Communications Commission. And though now retired from the commission, he has maintained a commitment to an inclusive, informative media landscape. Before joining the FCC, Copps served as Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Trade Development and Chief of Staff to U.S. Senator Fritz Hollings, Democrat from South Carolina, from the early 1970s to 1983. He has a Ph.D. in History from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Along with many others in an audience of 1,500 or so, I first became acquainted with then-FCC Commissioner Michael Copps when he and his fellow Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein spoke at the first Free Press National Conference on Media Reform in Madison, Wisconsin in 2003. Copps and Adelstein were speaking up in the public interest and against corporate media ownership consolidation. I am not the only one to watch Michael Copps in action for years and conclude that he was the very model of what a public servant should be. You've heard him on this show several times before, as well as on shows like Bill Moyer's Journal and Democracy Now! I reached Michael Copps on the phone last week to talk about last February's FCC vote for net neutrality and about media reform generally. Give a listen. Michael Copps, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back. Appreciate you having me on.
I want to get later into more specifically the net neutrality and some other issues, but I wonder if you could tell me a little bit first about your current position with Common Cause.
Well, after I left the Federal Communications Commission at the beginning of 2012, I wanted to stay involved in the issues that I felt very strongly about at the FCC, and that was media consolidation, the open Internet, local community radio, and things like that. So I wasn't ready to entirely hang up my hat, but I was looking for a way to have some impact there. My friend Bob Edgar, the late Bob Edgar, was then running Common Cause, which is the citizens' grassroots organization that attempts to expand our democracy and give voice to the people and control the power of big money in our electoral process specifically and our society generally. So Bob felt strongly about the media issues. I'd worked with him some when I was at the FCC, so he said, why don't we start a media and democracy reform program down here at Common Cause to pursue the issues that we both believed in? So I decided to give that a try, and we raised a little funding for it, and it's been going now for over two and a half years, something like that. We work with a lot of the public interest groups inside of Washington, D.C. on issues like open internet, disclosing political ads, broadcast political ads so people know who is behind them, all kinds of citizens issues, and we also have offices and staff in some 35 states, so it's a grassroots organization. And I've always been a firm believer that nothing good or very little good happens in Washington unless it's got some real grassroots oomph behind it, and I thought Common Cause would be a good place to do that. So I went into this thinking it would be kind of part-time, and more often than not, it ends up being a lot more than part-time, but I think we're having a positive effect, and we're going to keep at it.
I just found a release online that Bob Edgar wrote announcing you're taking that position. He said, "We see this initiative as a natural complement to our other efforts to counter the impact of big money on our politics and our elections, and to ensure that ours is a government of, by, and for the people." And this seems to go right along with what we've heard a lot about on this show. Frequent guest Bob McChesney, the media professor.
Right, he's great.
Dollarocracy, that he wrote with John Nichols.
Right.
That kind of puts forth the idea that whatever else you want to advocate or work for or are concerned about, you should concern yourself with two foundational issues: money and politics, Citizens United type stuff,
right,
and media reform. Your thoughts on any of that?
Well, I think Bob was very eloquent, and he put his finger on it. I don't think you can have reform in this country unless we have media reform. I don't think we can have democracy in this country unless we have media democracy. And the consolidation that we have been through in the last 20 or 30 years with just a few huge media giants gobbling up community outlets and local radio and local television has been highly destructive of local news. It's been highly destructive of national news, too, because these big companies are looking to entertain people, and they give them kind of infotainment, not even news light, just entertaining kind of stuff. And that really takes a toll over the course of time on the quality of your democratic dialogue, your civic dialogue, and the ability to inform citizens so that as citizens of this country, they can make intelligent decisions for our future. God knows we have some really serious and complex problems facing this country. We don't have any guarantee that we're going to get out of the ditch automatically. We're not on autopilot to soar to the stars or anything like that. We've got some really difficult challenges to face, and that requires an informed electorate. And I think most people agree that probably the electorate is less informed right now than it needs to be and than it has been at times in our past because we don't have a sufficiently vibrant media. So that's where media consolidation comes in. That's where open internet and net neutrality comes in. They're all related. But, you know, we've seen in so many industries this kind of consolidation. But it's particularly critical to avoid that in media. This is how we converse with one another, apart from you and me talking on the phone or talking it's how we communicate with one another unless we're just talking personally together. You have to have that communications infrastructure, and it needs to nourish a good civic dialogue, and that has not been happening.
Yes, and let's get into now that net neutrality angle of this.
Sure.
And this goes back at least to like 2002. We had a recent FCC vote, of course, that got some attention. But there's been court decisions, one overturning previous FCC decisions.
It's a mess.
Let's go over the history of that a little bit.
Well, I was there in 2002. Michael Powell was chairman of the Federal Communications Commission at that particular time. And he and the majority at that time, the GOP majority, decided to classify broadband communications as an information service rather than as a telecommunications service. Now, that may sound pretty in the weeds are pretty unimportant to a lot of people, but it was critically important because for years we had the telecommunications law, which protected telecommunications, telephones, and all of that. We had built up over the years consumer protections, privacy protections, getting the most advanced telecommunications possible out to all of our citizens, universal service, public safety. All these things were under the telecommunications Title II rubric of the Communications Act. Michael Powell was saying, and they passed this through the commission over my strenuous objections in 2002, no, we're just going to call it something else. We're going to call it information service, put it somewhere else in the telecommunications law where none of those other requirements and provisions benefiting consumers and citizens reside. So that's what they did in 2002. 2005, they extended it beyond cable modem to all the rest of telecom broadband. So I've been fighting this fight now for 13 years to reverse that and to put communications infrastructure, advanced telecommunications, which I think clearly include broadband, and I think Congress understood that back in 1996 when they passed the Act, get that back under Title II. I mean, it's because we advanced from more primitive to a more advanced telecommunications, so it means not telecommunications anymore. And goodness knows, with the important part in our life that broadband and the Internet play now, I mean, it's invested with the public good. It's invested with the public interest. It has to work for the people, not just for the companies who are making boatloads full of money off of it. So finally, after many years, in 2015, on February 26th of this year, the commission voted to reverse and to put advanced telecommunications, i.e. broadband, back under Title II of the Telecommunications Act. Now, the big companies don't like that. Some of them have already filed suit, even though the rules haven't been formally published yet. They kind of have jumped the gun, but there'll be suits. There's a lot of people in Congress and the other side of this who are going to throw every possible tactic and obstacle in the way of implementing this open Internet decision. That would have happened no matter what the FCC does, because everything the FCC does ends up in court sooner or later. But I felt, and a lot of other Americans felt too, that this was something that we had to do. If you are going to go to court, no matter what the FCC decides, let's go with the best legal case, and let's go with something that the American people believe in. Number one, this is the best legal case, and the courts have even told us that. In throwing out some kind of mild network neutrality rules that Chairman Jenikowski and the majority passed in 2010, the court said, you really can't do that the way you're classifying broadband right now as an information service, because there's nothing in that Title I information service part of the bill that lets you regulate it. Maybe you should have thought of Title II, and that's what some of us have been saying for since 2002. So the courts just about invited us to do this. Now, you know, it depends on what court you land in, how they're going to rule, and eventually it's going to go to the Supreme Court, and you can't make any ironclad predictions on how this is going to turn out, but again, it's the best and most solid legal case. In addition to that, it's something that the public has spoken very clearly on. Over 4 million Americans, the largest number ever to contact the FCC on a particular issue, contacted the FCC on the open Internet, on net neutrality, which is kind of a in-the-weedsy kind of term, and even going beyond that, asking for Title II, which sounds even more arcane, asking the FCC to do that. And people from little towns in Kansas to the current occupant of the White House contacted the FCC and said, you need to do this Title II classification. So, again, if we're going to have a long, drawn-out fight in Congress and elsewhere, it's nice to have the American people behind you, too. It's not a Republican-Democratic issue, I don't believe. I don't think most Republican voters in this country and citizens want people blocking content on the Internet or slowing down what they get or deciding where they can go any more than Democrats do. So It may be highly partisan here in Washington, where everything is highly partisan, but I don't think so out around the country. So I think we've got the best legal argument going, and we have good political winds behind us, including the administration, and it's just very important. There's one heck of a fight ahead of us. I mean, these companies are already not just suing and talking, but they're spending a lot of money on this. Their lobbying machine is going to be ramped up even more than it was probably before the vote. So it ain't over till it's over. But we took the big step, the commission took the big step on February 26th and did this reclassification, and God bless them for doing that. And I commend Chairman Wheeler. Originally people didn't think he was going to actually do this, but he actually did. And the two Democratic commissioners, Mignon Clyburn and Jessica Rosenworcel, for providing him the other two votes he needed to get a majority of the commission to get this done.
There's a lot of directions I want to go with this, but
okay. First,
even at risk of getting a little bit deep in the weeds in some sense, and even at risk of repeating some past shows where we've had this explained, some people like me need to have it drummed in several times before we totally grasp it. This whole Title II concept, and as I understand it, some of this goes back over 100 years or more to the concept of common carriage.
Yeah.
Can you explain that and work in something about the difference before this vote between oversight of wired internet and wireless internet?
Well, I think common carriage, and there's different definitions, I suppose. This means that facilities that are used by the public, transportation, roads, bridges, communications, even hotels, things like that, need to be open to everybody, that you can't discriminate, that you have to carry the traffic at just and reasonable terms, and as I say, not be discriminatory. That goes back a long, long ways. People have talked about, and I think that's what the FCC did, is that just like telephones were a common carriage, and that's the way they have been regulated, and even a lot of the wireless has been regulated already before this vote as under Title II, which I think implies or explicitly denotes common carriage. So now putting broadband under that is, I think, entirely logical. But I think we need to look at it just as telecommunity. You know, some people are saying, well, this is public utility regulation, and what's the definition of public utility? Well, I think it's a little bit different, common carriage a little bit different. I think we just have to look at this as this is our communications infrastructure. This is what we will all rely upon to communicate with one another. It's invested with the public good, and it needs to be open to all.
You know, it seems to me, and it seems to go along with some of what I've heard from net neutrality advocates online and with some of the organizations, that this is just kind of formalizing the kind of open internet we've had from day one. But
well, I think that's there's a large element of truth in that. We had, as I said, in 2010, some open internet rules. I didn't think they were strong enough. I was at the commission at the time and voted and tried to make them much stronger and put them, most importantly of all, under Title II. But Chairman Jenikowski and the others didn't want to. Most of the others didn't want to go. Go that far. So we didn't get there.
I was watching online after the fact that session of the FCC where this net neutrality vote took place, and by the way, I think I saw you in the audience, so you
I was there,
witnessed the whole thing. Yeah,
well, it was quite a feeling too to be there and looking up at the dais and where I had cast my vote against the 2002 classification, and now to see 13 years later, see the commission reverse it was kind of a bittersweet feeling. It was it felt good that we had achieved this victory, but I was just thinking, gosh, we wasted 13 years here. I didn't really finish probably on talking about some of what you asked there in the previous question about having an open internet, and I think we did get those 2010 rules. I think the big telecom companies realized that the FCC was watching, so they've been on relatively good behavior because they knew the FCC could act as has now acted. But there have also been several and numerous instances where we have had attempts at gatekeeping on the internet, where we have had things throttled, and where we have seen power exercised by big companies at the expense of consumers and citizens. So we're not, this Title II classification does not remake the internet. We're trying to keep it more or less like it has been, and do away with possibilities for further mischief as these companies continue to consolidate and come together. You know, we had the huge Comcast-NBCU merger a few years ago, which was not just cable, but broadband as well as broadcast distribution and content. Now we have Comcast, the number one cable company in the United States, trying to take over Time Warner Cable, the second largest, which was going to give Comcast a huge, vastly more power than any other broadband provider in the United States of America. So when you have that going on, and you don't have anybody protecting the public interest, then you're consigning this internet to a terrible and tragic fate. And it's tragic because this is the most open and dynamic and opportunity-creating technology in all of communications history. Never been anything like it. And it thrives on innovation and openness. And to let a few companies who don't want any regulation and they want monopoly market power to have their way is just to deny the potential of that open internet and that wonderful opportunity creating technology. And I think more importantly than that, it comes at terrible expense, or would come at terrible expense, to democracy. We can't do that. I mean, you know, I thought we had this debate in the early 1900s about when we were into antitrust and setting up some of the administrative agencies and all, and folks finally decided, you know, you can't let these people, you can't let a company own everything, own the content, own the distribution, and have no oversight whatsoever. I mean, that's fundamentally inimical to democracy. It's against everything that should be happening here. So it is terribly important. It's not just another industry going through a change. It's the industry that's at the heart. It's the lifeblood of our democracy, and it's the heart of our society. And it's invested, as I said before, with huge amounts of public interest. It's a public good. And just to turn it over lock, stock, and barrel and say, we're not even going to be watching you anymore, so laissez-les bon temps rouler, as they say, let the good times roll, to industry, would just be about the worst type of government policy that I can imagine.
Yeah. FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai spoke at some length before the vote that day.
Yes, he speaks at some length a lot.
And I don't know, maybe he didn't hear about these 4 million people that contacted the FCC that you mentioned earlier, but he said this net neutrality decision came about for one reason and one reason only: Obama told us to do so. And he said there'd been a 20-year bipartisan consensus for free and open internet, and this was a radical departure and an about-face from the FCC itself in those rules from last May. Your response?
Well, he apparently, when he says bipartisan, I don't know if he was familiar with any of the votes. He's a very smart guy, so I know he has been, with the dissents that I ushered, with the work that my colleague Jonathan Adelstein did when he was at the commission with me. It is not unusual, by the way, for a president of the United States to express an opinion on these things. Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush both got involved in the financial syndication rules, which we don't need to get into, but it was an important communications issue. George W. Bush urged Kevin Martin, then chairman after Michael Powell, to move ahead with an ownership proceeding. So the fact that President Obama iterated his support for an open internet is certainly in the tradition of the history of the FCC, and in fact, you can trace it farther back than that, Franklin Roosevelt's time, and all the way back to the beginnings of the Federal Communications Act in 1934. Now, the FCC is an independent commission and doesn't have to take that advice, but on the other hand, you know, it lives in the real world, and the president certainly has a right to talk about this. I mean, what it showed me when he came out for that is that the president really understands how important this is. This isn't just some little arcane communications issue down there that some agency is doing something that's important to the country. And if he didn't speak up, I think he'd be kind of derelict in his own duty to tell us how he feels. But I think the more powerful factor than that was the fact that 4 million Americans, long before the president issued his statements, on record at the FCC, for classifying broadband as a Title II telecommunications service.
Yeah, and Barack Obama campaigned in 2007 saying he would take a backseat to no one on this.
That's right, absolutely right.
And then it seemed like he was in the backseat for a few years. Nothing much happened with Jenikowski. And then he nominates this guy who was the head of two major trade organizations in the FCC purview. Were you surprised that it finally came to where it came on this?
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. I had heard all the things. I knew in principle that Obama talked about net neutrality and was for it, and that statement you talked about, I'll take a backseat to nobody. But it took some courage to do that because a lot of these big telecom companies, all of whom are active in political campaigns and political giving and all that, and who exercise inordinate power in Washington, D.C., were against him doing that. So I was pleasantly surprised that he did that. But I think we've seen since the last election, the president willing to be a little more independent-minded and using the power that he has, agencies and elsewhere, to get stuff done. But again, this is an independent agency that is certainly not bound to follow what he says. And Chairman Wheeler says in some respects, he went farther and in a little different direction than the president. People have to make up their own minds about that. But I don't see any problem there. I would be distressed if the president wouldn't speak up on an issue that's that important to the future of our communications and that important to the future of our democracy.
This is Tom Clammer, and we are having a conversation with former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, currently with Common Cause, and we'll be right back after you listen to this.
What if we had more hard-hitting journalism, more local stories, more quality kids' shows, more independent voices?
What if we had more people telling their friends about the vital information they hear on KKFI? What if we had more listeners supporting community radio in Kansas City and the surrounding area? Most of the nearly 2 million people our 100,000-watt transmitter can reach have never heard of us. What if more people helped us get more hard-hitting journalism and more local stories on the air on KKFI? What if more people realized the potential of KKFI and got involved in trying to reach that potential?
What if we had less celebrity fluff, less mind-numbing advertising, less partisan shouting, less junk TV? We need more public media, better public media, new public media, now.
And welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clammer, and former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps is on the line. Mr. Copps, you made a quick reference to FDR and the start of the FCC a few minutes ago. And there may have been others as well, but I did see one piece by Professor Victor Picard comparing this net neutrality with the Internet to the evolution or decisions on radio some decades ago. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and Victor Picard, who you mentioned, has written a wonderful book called America's Battle for Media Democracy. The subtitle is The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. One of the best books out this year, or this past year, I do believe. Highly recommend it. It's an interesting history that he tells, because reform really came later to the Federal Communications Commission than it did to a lot of the other agencies after Roosevelt became President of the United States in 1933. And it wasn't until, I forget the exact date, 36 or 37 or something like that, that his attention really seemed to swing more to the FCC, and he nominated somebody and selected somebody to be chairman down there named James Fly, who was very progressive, and in fairly short order, they had there were 7 members of the commission back then instead of 5 now. They had a majority for some pretty reformist things, like when they broke up the old red and blue networks, NBC, and one of them became, I think it was ABC, and did a number of other progressive things with regard to media. Roosevelt was very concerned, I think, at that time with the fact that newspapers were buying up radio stations and getting kind of a gatekeeper hammerlock again on our communications infrastructure, and he was more than happy to see something done on that, and that commission held a lot of hearings and issued some very progressive reports. And reform survived at the FCC for a little while after Roosevelt died. It had disappeared from a lot of other agencies because of the exigencies of the Second World War. But then in the late 40s, the FCC came out with some guidelines for broadcasters called the Blue Book, to the effect that, you know, you have to have good local coverage, you have to reflect the diversity of your community, put some limits on ads, cover political affairs, and other things like that. And the broadcasters had a major hissy over that, and what happened was they basically red-baited the Blue Book out of existence. Never was formally adopted, and this was one of the early examples of that kind of hysteria that we had during the McCarthy period and everything after the war. And after that, the commission seemed to get a little bit more conservative, but as I say, it lasted a little longer there. So it's interesting. It's a much more detailed history than I've just basically outlined here, but it's fascinating, fascinating history, because all the many biographies and histories that have been written of the Roosevelt administration, few of them go into this at all. You mentioned Bob McChesney earlier. He's written about it, and John Nichols and Paul Starr up at Princeton and some others. But Picard goes at it with a detail that nobody else has, because he's done research that nobody else has.
Yeah. Now, in the wake of this decision, I've seen some net neutrality advocates speaking up to the point that there's going to be court cases, and this is no time to let our guard down. And, you know, kind of like the media consolidation situation, you win victories, but then it keeps coming back like Arnold Schwarzenegger in the Terminator movies.
Well, you're right, and there's no doubt about it. I think as soon as that vote was cast, the big telecom company lawyers and lobbyists retreated to their favorite steakhouses and country clubs to figure out how they were going to reverse this vote, or how they were going to stymie it. Losing is not something that they are used to, so I think they spent a little time saying, well, what did we do wrong? Did we lobby this wrong? Did we approach Chairman Wheeler wrong? What did we do wrong? But then I think very quickly their vision starts to look forward and what they can do. And you can already see what's going on. I mean, suits have been filed already. They're going to be more. They're doing everything they can on Capitol Hill to develop opposition to this on any front they can. If you can't just overturn Title II, maybe they can deny funds to the commission to implement them. All sorts of things they can do. You know, it's interesting. We talked about the FCC being an independent agency, and the propriety of the president getting involved, but the Congress doesn't see it that way at all. They see the FCC as subject primarily to Congress, and they don't have any compunctions about telling you what to do and all of that. Some of them are a little more fastidious about it than others, but some of them up there just who talk about the vaunted independence of the agency, they don't see their own relationship with the agency that way. So this will be a big issue going forward, and it'll be an issue in and of itself. And then there's some talk about rewriting the entire Telecommunications Act going forward, so that's going to be something else we'll hear about, and whether the net neutrality debate will be folded into that or whatever, goodness only knows. But nobody should sit back and relax. Citizens can, I think we're all entitled to celebrate this victory because it was hard, difficult to achieve, and long in coming. But the battle is far from over. But, you know, it's just like everything in a democracy. I mean, every generation has to fight to not just to vindicate it, but to keep it and to preserve it and to advance it. And you're never going to get this golden age of communications where everything is not only good and right for the present, but for the future, too. I mean, this is an ongoing battle. It's a messy business, democracy, but it's worth the fight.
Yeah, and I've been thinking for quite a while that this struggle over media ownership consolidation is a huge lesson that more of us ought to study and think about a little more. As we just said, that you win a battle, you can't put everything down and think okay, it's over with, because it keeps coming back. You have to win another battle.
Right, and this one isn't anywhere near over. I mean, it's not just this issue, and it's not that this is the totality of all Internet issues either. I mean, the Internet is going to change and evolve, and we're going to have some good policies to make sure it's kept open and innovative and all the rest. And we have all of this consolidation, which is apart from the open Internet thing as far as proceedings at the FCC goes. They have the Comcast Time Warner Cable merger that I mentioned a few minutes before. There's AT&T DirecTV. There's always something. And I noticed Charter and Bright House Cable Companies getting together here just the other day. It's merger mania. And again, I think it's time the Commission starts saying no to some of these things and put some localism and diversity back into our media and gives a little more support and encouragement to community radio, to public radio, to public educational and governmental channels, and try to diversify the news and information that the American people get, and to have real local news and have some real investigative journalism. One of the unfortunate byproducts of all of this consolidation has been the virtual demise of good investigative journalism, because the first thing these companies do when they have these huge transactions, they're looking for, oh, now we got to pay for the transactions, we need money, where do we cut? And where they go in the first instance, it seems, is to the newsroom. And you know this much better than I do, I'm sure, but we've lost tens of thousands of newsroom jobs since 2000. Maybe 20-30% of our newsroom people, and our civic dialogue has suffered because of that. So there are a whole raft of problems out there, and we really need to have an intelligent discussion about the evolving future of our telecommunications and the Internet, and how we really make it work for folks. And net neutrality, open Internet was part of that, but as I say, it's not the totality of it. We need to figure out how we're going to nourish these other sources of information. I talked about public radio. The only debate we have in Washington is whether to cut it out entirely or keep it at the low level it's funded right now. I think in our country we spend per capita on public radio every year something like $1.86 the last time I looked, whereas in other countries, they spend, up in the hundreds of dollars on to support independent news and public radio. And when you mention that in Washington, of course, people say, oh, well, that's the government taking over the media. We can't have that. That's propaganda. But it's an interesting fact that some countries on this planet that are judged to be more democratic even than the United States of America have vibrant government-supported public media, a lot of the Scandinavian countries and several others. The Economist magazine, relatively conservative, highly respected periodical that a lot of folks are familiar with, has their democracy index, and they come out every year, and the United States isn't anywhere near the top of it, but some of these countries that have spent a little bit more money on informing their electorate and all are, and they've managed to erect those firewalls to make sure there's no government intrusion in the content that goes on public radio. So that's just one thing. Community radio. On the internet itself, how do we encourage smaller startups, different sources of news, and it's a huge problem with lots of different dimensions, and we don't pay enough attention to it in this country. Thank goodness the internet, open internet issue got a lot of attention, but that's just part of the battle, just a phase of the battle, and that's what keeps me involved in this and keeps you interested in it, too.
Yeah, and I really am struck by those things that you brought up, like the Economist ranking by specific criteria, the United States and so forth. I think Nichols and McChesney did some work on this. Also, the very same countries that spent the most on government-subsidized media ranked the best in freedom of the press and freedom generally and all these kinds of things. And as you said, insulated this from being turning into some kind of Pravda or something.
Right, exactly.
And as somebody once said, there's no news in Izvestia, no truth in Pravda, but I think we get, maybe we're not so conscious of it, but we get something like what we perceive Soviet censorship and Pravda news with this
corporate control. And I'm not arguing that we need 24-hour, 7-day-a-week news coverage and documentaries and all that. But goodness sakes, you've got to, with all the complex issues we've got out there, you've got to have a journalism that's digging for the facts, that's funded to find the truth, that can write the investigative story, that can inform the American people. But a lot of these companies just go for the lowest common denominator and infotainment. That's my old colleague Jonathan Allison used to use an analogy about to McDonald's. We all love McDonald's hamburgers, and we all love to eat them, but you can't eat them all the time without endangering your health. And I think so it goes with our media. It's fine to have all the entertainment programs and all that, but if you don't have some necessary component of serious news and analysis, if you don't cover a House of Representatives race in your state, how can the people make an informed decision? And to stop and think about it, when did you last see on TV station a news-centered report before an election on your local House of Representatives race? Very, very seldom that you see that. Maybe they'll talk about the Senate race and the horse race aspects of it, but they focus on the horse race aspects of it and who's raising the most money and who's up and down in the polls. But all the issues that we should be discussing on the eve of an election are shortchanged, and that means that democracy is shortchanged.
Yes, and you talked about what a huge amount of professional or number of professional journalists we've lost, and doing something like being a volunteer host producer of a public affairs shows like I am now really kind of brings home what should probably be obvious on its face, that real investigative journalism takes resources. It takes
money. I'm proud of what I do, having people like you on the show talking about issues. But, you know, I don't have the expertise or the resources or the time to do a lot of real investigative journalism that used to be done by newspapers.
Right.
The advertising model for supporting that is gone. What's your thoughts on what?
And you do a real public service and serve the public interest by what you're doing. But and I'm amazed there are still young folks, and I'm happy that want to get into journalism. But boy, they're getting into a difficult field. And if they're lucky enough to get a job with one of these big companies, and they're lucky enough to be a reporter, you know, they're told, well, instead of the maybe 100 years ago, the publisher or the editor of the paper would have said, go out and spend 2 months or 3 months or 6 months or whatever it takes to develop this story, and that's how we had good investigative reporting. Now, more often than not, it's, well, go out and cover this story for an hour or so, and if it gets enough hits, we'll keep covering it. Otherwise, go do this story. And as soon as you do three or four stories, and by the way, you take your own camera with you because we don't have a cameraman anymore to go, so you do that. Then come back and we'll put you on the station, but you also got to do a blog and blah, blah, blah. So how can a poor reporter, how can she or he find the time to do the kind of research that's necessary to really dig into what's going on this country of ours and hold power accountable? Look at what's happened to State House reporting. It's just a shell of what it used to be, what's going on in our capitals. And there's actually a hell of a lot more legislation that's getting passed at the state level than there is in deadlocked Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
But it's barely covered unless it's one of these things like we have this week with the with the gay and lesbian issue or something like that. But who's making money off of this bridge or road, or what's this politician's connection with this company, and blah, blah, blah. That stuff we don't get so much anymore.
Right. We've just got a few minutes left. You've mentioned community radio and public radio, and, you know, there's lots of things I like about public TV and public radio, but there's a lot of shortcomings there, too, as they're more and more in fear of getting their funding cut. They more and more worry about offending private funders. I thought this, if I'm not shifting gears too quickly here, this LPFM thing that Obama signed into a law after, you know, a decade or more of work by activists to have all these low-power FM stations across the country. I'm not a real policy wonk. I don't have hard data, but my impression is that, you know, while there were, I think, maybe a couple thousand, 2,000 or less licenses applied for, this was also a huge opportunity that could have been many more stations. That was kind of, this opportunity slipped away because not enough people got organized about that to do that. I mean, imagine several thousand new stations doing hyper-local public affairs and maybe carrying something like Democracy Now! To offset some of this massive conversion of like the AM radio in the past couple of decades to all right-wing stuff. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a huge believer in low-power FM, low-power television, too, for that matter. It was kind of stymied for years and years after 2000 until a couple of years ago, and finally we got some good legislation passed, thanks to people like Mike Doyle in the House of Representatives from Pennsylvania and a number of others, which encouraged the commission to open up a window so that we could get back to actually licensing low-power radio stations. There were relatively few, as you said, a few hundred at most on. So the window was open. Some kind of deal was made between using the spectrum for this and some of the translators and the religious broadcasters rely on and all of that. That's important, too, but you can't let it run the low-power FM stations off of the air, and you have to make room for lots of new ones. So I don't know the exact number of people that applied in this new window, but I know that the opportunity was created for them to do so. Now, that being said, it takes money. I think it's helpful, though, in the localities to have that kind of program. It only covers a small area, but if you get enough of them, it can make a difference. It's not a substitute so that we can forget, obviously, about the major media outlets, the licensed outlets and all of that, because so much of the problem resides there. But it is some diversity. It is some variety. It is some localism. And in so many of these cities you go to now, diversity groups, minorities aren't represented. Not only don't they have their own stations, not only are they not holding a lot of jobs in the broadcast industry, but the issues don't even get covered. I travel the country on that media ownership issue that we talked about earlier, and you go to some places and it was just heartrending. People would get up and say, I'm a member of this or that minority community, and we're doing all of these good things, and nothing gets covered from our community except bad news and negative news, and there's so much to do, and we don't feel that we have not any input. We're not being depicted for the people that we are or the contributions we make. And that's just, diversity should be the strength of the United States of America. It's not a problem to be overcome. It's an opportunity to be taken advantage of. And in our media, we have done a woefully bad job of taking advantage of that diversity and making it work for America.
If I may, one more thing before I let you go. I talked earlier about what I see as the huge lessons of the net neutrality fight and the media ownership consolidation fight. And one of them, to my mind, is that grassroots people can make a huge difference. Like in the media ownership consolidation, besides the impact of millions of people contacting the FCC and their senators and congressmen, their voices were cited by the federal court in one of the big decisions as being very important to consider. Anything you have to say to the listeners about you can make a difference if you will come together and act a little more strategically?
Well, you put it so well, because I have always believed that real systemic reform in this country does not come to us as a gift from our representatives in Washington or something that Washington in its great generosity decides to confer on the people. Real systemic and important reform, from abolitionism through workers' rights and women's rights and civil rights and disability rights and LGBT rights and all of that, that stuff got its boost and from the grassroots. That's where the push came from to get this done. So even in this era, when outrageous amounts of money seem to control so much and we get so frustrated and think, oh, gee, there's not anything we can do against that power of those big people, there is. And it's uphill and it's hard, but it can be done when you get millions of people organized. When you get that senator and congressman coming home and holding a town hall meeting, and somebody from a town in Kansas or anywhere in the country goes out and says, hey, what about this net neutrality? What about this media consolidation? Then they begin to take notice. Then they know it's an issue back home, and it might translate into votes. I saw that happen in the media ownership, and I think it happened here with this net neutrality thing. So I think we can take heart, and when we really believe in something, we should be talking to our family and our friends and our workplace colleagues and our student friends and whatever local media will listen, and all of our officials on the local and federal level, and let them know how we think. And that's hard work. It takes some effort, but it's certainly worth it. But what really helps that happen is a media that actually tees up those issues and says, well, here's some other issues about the Internet, not just net neutrality, or here's some other issues about media ownership that you didn't know about, not just newspaper broadcast cross-ownership, or here's the other side of public television or community radio debate. But, yes, I wouldn't still be doing this stuff at my age, if I didn't really believe that it was important and a fight worth fighting. And I am, encouraged by the fact that we have had this victory recently. Now our job is to preserve, protect, and defend it, and make sure that the special interests who are counting on us to let our guard down now, that we don't do that, and that we preserve what we've won.
Well, Michael Copps, there's a lot more I'd like to talk to you about, but I guess we're about out of time. I really appreciate you coming on the show today. CommonCause.org, any other website or source of information you'd like to
go to that CommonCause.org. It's a good one. Go to Media and Democracy, but there are other organizations in Washington like Public Knowledge, Free Press, Center for Media and Democracy, Color Change, a whole bunch of groups that are involved in this fight, and they all are fighting the good fight and need our support.
Okay, well, thank you again very much.
Thanks for having me on, and thank you for continuing your coverage of this issue and for all the good work you do to advance the public interest.
Former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps. A quick programming note, besides all the other wonderful programming here on your community radio station, April looks to be an especially good month for alternative radio. You can hear David Barsamian's Alternative Radio every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. on KKFI, right after Democracy Now! Next Wednesday, April 15th at 9, you'll hear a favorite of mine, Wes Jackson, talking about restoring Earth Island. If you know who Wes Jackson is, you know it's worth your while to mark your calendar and tune in. And if you don't know who Wes Jackson is, you need to tune in and find out. Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.